and welcome to episode 70 of Whisky Talk from the Scotch Malt Whisky Society. I'm Richard Goslin, editor of the Society's members magazine, Unfiltered. Regular listeners will know that we're fortunate at the Scotch Malt Whisky Society to welcome representatives from distilleries who visit us in our members' rooms, share some special samples of their whiskies with our members, and give us their insights and knowledge about their distilleries. In March, we had a visit to the vaults by Himanshu Ashar from Paul John, the pioneering Indian distillery based in Goa on the country's tropical west coast. Before enjoying the tasting, I took the chance to find out more about Paul John Distillery, India's whisky journey since it gained independence in 1947, and what tropical maturation brings to this spirit. Welcome to the vaults, Himanshu. Have you been here before?
I have been here before, before the renovation as well.
Right.
But it was mainly a business meeting.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So you're here for the tasting tonight. Some of our members might have had the chance to taste Paul John whiskey before, but tell us a little bit about the distillery, its history and its place in the world of Indian whiskey.
First, I think we are making Paul John single malts in Goa, and we've been doing this since 2009, but officially we launched it in 2012, and so the project started somewhere around 2005. But in the heart of it, the company was formed in 1996, and under the chairman Paul P. John himself, and he went into manufacturing of spirits, primarily whiskey, with a brand which was an economy brand called Original Choice Whiskey. And from there, somewhere in around 2006, the journey to premiumize the portfolio started. And then we began that portfolio with wines. And then we moved on to single malts as well, because India is predominantly a whiskey consuming country.
Yeah.
So we had a malt plant already, because we used to add the malt spirit into our whiskies, and that got converted into the single malt project, and that happened to be in Goa.
Okay.
So since 2012, we launched it in the UK, and then the journey has begun, and there has been no turning back. So today we are in many states of India. Which is important, because you are selling within a country. And then we are in more than 45 countries in the world, and almost 19 duty-free global travel retail. So in a span of about 12 years, I think the journey has been exhilarating.
It sounds like it. How is the Indian whisky scene? I was fortunate to spend some time in India. I know that Indians love their whisky.
Absolutely.
But they weren't drinking, high quality Indian whisky.
Right.
Certainly the people I was drinking whisky with.
Right.
They were desperate to get their hands on Scotch.
Yes.
But how would you describe the scene at the moment?
So let me just go back when we got our independence. Or when we had our Brexit.
Yeah. Okay.
In 1947.
We're going back in time.
Back in time. So, we had to sustain the grains to feed our nation, right? That was the key priority of being sustainable, to provide sustenance to our own people. So the grains were off limits. The grains, cereals, anything material that could be converted into food was off limits to convert to alcohol. So then the country moved to the cash crop, which was sugarcane, right? Which was produced in abundance in parts of India. And we decided, the country then moved on to taking the refined sugar out of it and then putting the molasses and fermenting it further and getting it distilled to get alcohol. But, you know, this is not new. Why? Because, you know, world over, countries have produced alcohol from food surpluses. So if you take, you know, Poland or Russia or the Eastern Europe, they had potatoes. So they drew their alcohol base. It's just that they called it as vodka. If you look at, Scotch, it came from barley because there was a huge production of grain in reverse to the population that was consuming it. If you go to the Americas, it was the corn. So everybody created their own narrative, which is fine. Now, unfortunately, we did not have that narrative at that time. So we called it whiskey because we were adding to that extra neutral alcohol, okay, flavors, artificial, natural, depending on the pricing you wanted to go. If you wanted to make it a little bit more premium, you would add a percentage or a dosage of malted spirits or even scotch or a blend of grain whiskies to make it into a different laddering. Because at that point of time, India was not, I would say, as affluent as it is today, right? So it had to meet that price point.
Sure.
Right? And of course, we had the taste of the scotch, and hence it became an aspirational thing. So there was a big gap between what was available as local produce and what was, as that is country liquor, that is fermenting anything, and what was, you know, imported, because the whole availability was a problem and all of that. So in came in the middle, where you had a cheap, reliable source, because it's a cash crop, so it has a predictive cycle, which could be utilized for making the base spirit. And then you could do whatever you could to do to build that market. Today, if you look at the journey of the premium, good quality whiskies, is built on those base. Because we had to go through that and the economic growth to reach to an aspirational point where today we are able to talk about creating a category called the Indian single malt category.
Yeah, and there's been so much change in such a short period of time.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, just in my own experience of India, every time I returned, it was like, you know, it advanced so much in a very compressed time period.
And as you have talked about just before we started this conversation, you talked about how the media tsunami came in and you were involved in that movement of that. Similarly, in every aspects have been in, it's not just one sector that has grown. So it's newer sectors, newer technology driven enterprises have come in, which just started as, you know, a call center back to the US or UK, selling insurance or solving complaints, today became completely an IT juggernaut.
Yeah.
Similarly, there were several other enterprises, whether we are talking about, you know, aviation now, or whether we are talking about, you know, automobile, we are talking about industries which are built to scale in terms of manufacturing. All that is now happening at a very rapid pace. And so also has been the journey for the Indian single malt, that within a span of, I think, 15 to 20 years, there has been exponential growth. And the last 5 years has been explosive.
Yeah. And has the focus then been on international growth first or domestic?
You know, I think there are many layers to this question. So the first is that it's easier to do business outside than to do business in India, to be in most states. But India is a growing country, and it's a rapidly growing country. It's the largest market, so you can't ignore it. But if, you know, if one is producing a quality whiskey or a quality produce of anything, it is important to explore the international markets with the core whiskey markets, if I am. I'm just using whiskey as an example. So it's important to look at UK because it has been in the epicenter of the whiskey world, for example. The US, France, which, so though we the wine overshadows, but France is a spirit drinking and a whiskey drinking market as well. Japan, Australia, which is kind of embracing whiskey as well. So all these markets have been in a certain, either the beginning of it or in the forefront of it, or have been rapidly growing. So it's important to be successful there because it is a palate test as well, that whether you stand up to the acceptance of a very evolved palate, very evolved market. Like I'm sitting in Edinburgh, and I have obviously know that you walk into any shop or a bar, there are at least, you know, scores of whiskey from every region. Now, if you are able to see an international section, that means that the diversity and inclusiveness exists.
Yeah.
And when you are able to put that as an offering and it gets accepted, I think the reflection of the quality, like even in an award or in a competition, if it gets judged in a good position or in a top position or a best whiskey in the world kind of a position, then it really draws a quality parameter back in India.
Yeah.
Whilst the volume growth will definitely come from there, but the learning and the imagery growth comes from the international markets.
Okay.
And then there is then I would say the media picks it up, and then we are able to create a virtuous cycle.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you're just right in the middle of that cycle just now, where the Indian market is recognizing the quality of what's been produced within their own country.
The surf is up.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
And tell me a wee bit about the setup at the distillery. I've not been lucky enough to visit, but tell me just the kind of production setup that you've got in Goa.
So we are first located in south of Goa. We are not, though Goa is on the seashore of the west coast, we are not on the banks of a sea like some distilleries are. We are a little in the hinterland or in the mainland. We are in a industrial place called Kunkolim, and so we started with two pot stills. Then we expanded into, now we just finished our expansion, and we now have a production of 6,000 liters per day.
Okay.
So that gives us an ability to also scale. And that's why it's all, you know, a catch 22, how many markets you want to enter with vis-a-vis how much liquid you had at the back and so on and so forth. So that has been our endeavor as well, to ensure the growth is not missed. So we have about 30,000 odd barrels, and we are scaling that as well. As we speak, we have our master distiller Michael D'Souza, who would be with the project since beginning. He has been with us for nearly 30 years, so it was his I would say baby to create the distillery under the vision of our chairman Paul Pigeon. And today we also have a visitor center, and the first of its kind of visitor center in India, and which has again been recognized as one of the best visitor centers as well. So we are welcoming, I would say, the whiskey aficionados, and we are, I would say, the journey has just begun, because a very significant part of our endeavor is to educate, as you were talking about, what kind of whiskies are now coming and how is the Indian market responding to.
Yeah.
A very good part is about educating. And the visitor center has been the epicenter for us. So the distillery not only serves as production, but our visitor center, which is attached to the distillery, also serves as you know, an emanating place for all the whiskey, all things whiskey.
Yeah. So is it, would you describe it as a Scottish style of whiskey making? It's pot still, it's inspired by...
I'll give you an analogy. First, let me just put this to rest. We do exactly as per the Scotch whiskey guidelines.
Okay.
So the mash bill is 100% malt. It is copper pot distilled twice. It is aged in American white oak barrels for a minimum of 3 years. Right? That is put to rest. But that's as much as we now, this is scratching the surface. Then as we go down below, first thing, it's very simple. The tea in your place and the tea in my place with the same ingredients will taste different, right? The same thing happens in whiskey as well. So if you look at the ingredient, starting with the barley, now in Europe and in Scotland, it's the 2-row barley, right? In India, it's the 6-row barley. So the basic ingredient itself. Now there is a difference between the 2-row and the 6-row. The 6 rows, like the rows of the corn, are the rows of the barley. That means it has got more husk, right? The material itself, the grain itself, has more protein and less carbohydrate. That means the yeast really has to muscle in and convert the sugars into alcohol. And when it does that, when it's muscling in, it is actually creating textural because of the proteins on the palate, and as we will taste in the evening. So that is the starting point. Obviously, as you know, a master distiller will have several options of what are the boiling temperatures, what is the crisp ratio, what is the fermentation, what yeast to use, what is the... And in terms of one of the differences that we have is that our still safes are not locked. So our cutting of the head, hearts and the tails are organoleptic processes and not timed processes.
Okay.
So though it is the same, but our work on the process is different than the time. So again, you have a better flexibility, so as to speak. You have a better control as well, because then you are trying to get the spine, the distillate, completely right. And then we have the American oak. So most of our whiskies are ex-bourbon, and though as per Scotch whiskey guidelines, it's matured for 3 years, but the catch is it's matured here for tropical 3 years.
Yeah.
So Goa, as you know, 300 days of sunshine, about 25 to 30 degrees average temperatures, 85% humidity. So the cask, being a living thing, is responding very differently.
Yeah.
Right? So to give you an analogy, if you take 2 teacups, one with cold water, one with hot water, take the same 2 tea bags and dip it in, you would see in the cold water, which is at 1 degree, the conversation between the water and the tea bag is not even started for the first few minutes. Whereas in the hot water, the water is leaching out color, flavor, aroma at a very rapid pace. Now, if I were to enjoy both the cups of tea, I would have to have this first, because this will get brewed very quickly, and I would have to wait for this. Whilst this is a hot brew, this is a cold brew, right? Now, I have to give time for this, and both are delicious in their own way. I would have to give time for it to fully develop, give me color, aroma, taste. Whilst this, if I keep it longer, A, it's also evaporating. B, it would then have more tannic flavors,
yeah,
and it would not be enjoyable.
Yeah. How much evaporation do you, what's the angel share loss?
Yeah. So
compared with Scotch.
So my final pledge on this is we are the hot brew of whiskey.
Okay.
So whilst the cold cup of tea represents Europe, Scotland, higher Japan, we represent the hot countries which make whiskey, like Taiwan for that matter, which also has similar temperatures. We in India have similar temperatures across India. Even Kentucky has that level of. So, you know, it's just that. So coming to your question about the Angel's share. So the first year, we lose about 10% as compared to 2 or 3%.
Yeah.
The subsequent years is about 8%.
Okay.
So, and it gets reducing. So even then, if you look at the evaporation, and in that, there's a little bit of detail there. With 85% humidity, we don't lose much water. We lose alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's all humid around, so the alcohol that evaporates. So our new make, which is at 63, and our single cask comes out anywhere between 57, and if you're lucky, up to 59.
Okay.
So we lose the alcohol that much, whereas in the drier parts, they lose more water and the alcohol goes up. So
what age do you tend to age your whiskies too?
So everything, as we start today with Nirvana as our part of the first flight, is 3 years, three tropical years.
Yeah.
So one tropical year of aging is anywhere between 3 to 4 years of aging in a cold climate. So everything starting from Nirvana and upwards is around 3 years plus.
Okay. Has that been a challenge to educate an international market in terms of, you know, a lot of people are fixated on time in terms of the number of years of maturation, but are you able to tell that story in terms of the tropical maturation and people accept it?
Aging is not an option. Maturing is.
Yeah.
So, and that's why I have this job. As a global brand ambassador, that's the hat that I'm wearing. So that's the job, because the narrative for us is not time. But the narrative is we want to present to you what the cask has intended to give. And hence, most of our whiskies are 46% and above,
mm-hmm.
non-chill filtered, really showcasing what the six-row barley malt, the cask, and Goa has given us in that time.
And how would you describe all of these elements in terms of the flavor impact that you're getting in Paul John whiskies?
So I would say that, you know, if you look at malt, we get the textural part of it from the malt, the honeyness. The honey comes from the there's a sweetness that comes. Then we obviously get the honeyed notes and the vanillic notes from the cask. We are in a tropical place, so we really get a lot of tropical notes of pineapple, orange in our distillate. We also have a little bit of sea salt brininess, not the iodine Isla style, but a sea salt brininess. Which is coming from being closer to the coast. And I would say the cask influences, which we have, where we have, that brings in the honeycomb sweetness, that depth to the whole thing. As we will see today, you will really see the influence of the cask, and then the cask finishes that we have in wine, cask finishes as well, which I will be delighted to showcase. Sometimes when we have used a virgin oak, you really see the extraction of the flavors and the aroma and the color that has happened, which I'll be also happy to showcase that today. Because we are not keeping the cask in any controlled temperatures. They are just kept in a place where the air is circulated so as to, you know, make the environment safe for the people who are working there or touring there, because we are losing so much of alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just to make it safe. But there is no temperature control to our cask. So all in all, I would say you get the depth from the cask, the tropicalness, the fruitiness, the sweetness from the malt, and then the time, the Goa, really takes and sets in.
Okay.
So complexity comes in different casks. We also have virgin oak as well. So we also do our cask finishes in wine cask as well. So these also gives us a lot of layering of flavors on what our master distiller is aiming for. And we also have finer and subtle casks or whiskies, like the wine cask finishes and the elegant whiskies, in our basement below the visitor center.
Mm-hmm.
So those are more gentler and more sophisticated. Our line arm of the copper pot still is tall and angular, so that itself defines the style of whiskey that we are going for. So it's subtle and aromatics, not the heavier flavors.
Yeah. Okay. And I suppose you've been at the forefront at Paul John in terms of Indian whiskey finding an international market and an international reputation. How would you describe the scene now in India in terms of other whiskey makers coming on the scene? Are we going to see more Indian whiskey coming on the international market? Is that a dynamic scene in terms of that kind of growth?
Yes, I think we are definitely seeing more players and more actors in the market. But we are very careful that these actors are bringing credibility to the category, because you know, one or two players cannot just drive the category. You need more quality producers to drive the category. It's evolving. It is the new gold rush, so as to speak. So everybody has plans, but it is important to have the right plans.
If you haven't tasted any Paul John whiskey yet, you're in for a treat. Even more so if it's one of the Society's single cask bottlings from Distillery 134. If you look on the website and you're a member of the Society, you might just be in luck. Look out for more distillery visits coming up at our members' rooms, or tasting events or masterclasses coming to one of our partner bars or a hotel near you soon. That's it for this episode of Whiskey Talk. Until the next time, cheers.